title was Household is Dark Matter.
Yeah, that's what I will mainly talk about, but depending on how many questions you ask, I will get to the second part of the talk too and tell you a bit about something else, what's a bit more in the future. I wasn't quite sure who to expect here, so I have aimed at a bit at people I may have expected at PI. So I tried to make it less astrophysicky than I would normally speak. So bear with me if there's maybe a bit more general introduction than you are from the astrophysical side. So what I will mainly talk about is using absorption line spectra to say something about how cold dark matter is. And I would like to try to convince you that for astrophysical purposes, you can actually consider it just as cold dark matter. And that's something what has been discussed for a while, warm dark matter. And I will also make that clear that that's a bit of fuzzy definition, what that actually means, that is actually ruled out. So we have this nice paradigm that's now very well fixed that everybody calls lambda CDM. And as you know, that C stands for cold dark matter. And but if you look at that and look at the scales, you becomes immediately clear that that's actually not tested to very small scales. So what we would actually like to know to what extent we actually have cold dark matter. And if you go to smaller scales, there's a wide range of what could happen. If you go to larger K, depending on what the dark matter actually is, you expect a cutoff at some scale, which might be at very high K and very small scale, or it might be a progressively larger scale, depending on what the dark matter is. And if it's stellar neutrinos, thermogravitinos, or supervims, for certain models of these could actually be relevant for astrophysics and for galaxies. While if it's really on the other end of the spectrum, if it's a supersymmetric, light a supersymmetric particle, it would be virtually cold. And that's what normally people use as to discriminate between the different kinds of dark matters. And that's what I meant, that the definition is somewhat fuzzy. And so with cold dark matter, we mean that the free streaming scale is so small that it is astrophysically actually irrelevant. And what is astrophysically irrelevant changes a bit with time. For warm dark matter, we expect free streaming on galaxy scales, so it might actually affect the way galaxies evolve and form. And hot dark matter basically has been ruled out a while ago, so the free streaming scale is so large that it affects cluster scales. If you want to have galaxies in this kind of model, you form clusters first and fragment into galaxies. I think our knowledge is now such that we can firmly rule that out. And that's basically a question how warm dark matter is. There's a number of potential problems with cold dark matter. Something what has been traveling for quite a while is a small scale crisis of cold dark matter. And the main 2 points there are that this cold dark matter, you might expect a lot of small-ish galaxies, and there are many small halos, and as you go to smaller and smaller masses, there will be more and more of them, and I will show a few pictures later. And the question was, are these actually there? Are they in accordance with what we see? And there was this idea that there might be not enough of them, and that there's a discrepancy, and I will try to convince you that that basically has gone away. The other thing is that cold dark matter might predict dark matter halos that have profiles that are too cuspy to be consistent with what we see in some galaxies. And if you look at galaxies of different sizes, as you go to the smaller galaxies, you find that they're more and more dark matter dominated, and they seem to have very pronounced cores. And that is somewhat challenging to get in cold dark matter scenarios, but I think it's not impossible. And I'm not so sure if that's fully resolved from the astrophysical side of, but I don't think that warm dark matter will be the solution to it. So in warm dark matter candidates, there's a wide range of candidates that have been discussed. It's quite often generically discussed in terms of early decoupling thermal relics. This would be the more massive cousins of normal neutrinos that basically just have smaller velocities, have a free streaming scale that's smaller than that of neutrinos because the thermal velocities of the particles are smaller. And that in this way, that's an easy way of thinking about it. There's a lot of other candidates that have similar properties where the interpretation becomes more model dependent. One very popular one are sterile neutrinos that are not necessarily thermal. Gravitinos in certain models, and there are many more of them. So what the warm dark matter actually does is that it cuts off the power spectrum. And in the range of masses and free streaming lengths that are still relevant, it's actually just this cutoff of the power spectrum that's relevant. The actual velocities are so small at low redshift that if you look at astrophysical incarnations of that, that you, the velocities are actually not important. It's a cutoff in the power spectrum due to the free streaming. So there's a certain scale in K, you have a very sharp cutoff due to free streaming. And these masses on that plot here, this cutoff in K, and in this case, in the bottom, it's in megaparsec, on top it's in velocities, and the reason why it's in velocities on the top is because I will talk a lot about spectra later, and the natural units there are velocities instead of doing it in real space, you do it in redshift space. And the masses there are all for thermal relics. So on the scales that we will talk about later, you can see something about tens of a kV to 1.4 kV, and if you go to the right redshifts, you can push it up to even several kV. And I will present you with what I think are the best limits on that, and you get these from looking at the neutral hydrogen distribution, and I will take you a bit through what we have done there. So this is a numerical simulation of two models. One is for these purposes cold dark matter, meaning that there is no cutoff in the power spectrum that's visible on the resolution scale of the simulation. While on the right of side, you have a warm dark matter particle, in this case of 0.5 kV. And you see what I mean with free streaming. The particles initially have still relevant thermal velocities. These wash out some of the fluctuations, and what that means is that the picture just becomes a little bit more fuzzy and the small scale structure goes away. And what we will look, try to look at is actually at a distribution like this, where it's easier, what people have discussed too and what I've alluded to with the small scale crisis, is that if you look at the nonlinear evolution of a density field like this, you get the halos. These are galaxy size halos, and if I have a cutoff in the power spectrum, I have much less small scale structure, and much less small mass halos. And there the idea is to see if what we see in our, for example, in our local group in terms of small galaxies, if that corresponds more to one on the right-hand side or on the left-hand side. And the frightening thing is these many small halos that you see in cold dark matter. I think the resolution to that, I think, is almost certainly astrophysical, that most of these little lumps you just don't see, because they don't form stars efficiently. They form a few stars, blow out the gas, and are just not visible for this reason. So what we have used as a tracer of the matter distribution is neutral hydrogen as it absorbs distant objects. And what is seen here is a display of the dark matter distribution, and then there are here the different traces of the matter distribution that you could use. And quite often people use galaxies, and as you see, the galaxies trace these filamentary structures well. And if you make assumption about the bias, you can actually learn something about this distribution and maybe the small scale cutoff too. But that doesn't go to the right scales that you're interested in. What we are using is a gas distribution. So this is a hydrodynamic simulation, and we use a neutral hydrogen. And as you can see, there's a one-to-one correspondence to the density fields in the dark matter and the neutral hydrogen. And the reason why that's favorable to do is because here you can basically go to the genes mass of that gas, and that is at the smaller scales as you can get, and that allows you to probe the cutoff to high K, and therefore you get from this the best contributions. So what you use to probe the neutral hydrogen is absorption in the relevant Lyme alpha line. So you use a Lyme alpha transition, and the reason why that is a very powerful method is because it's a resonant line, and even small traces of neutral hydrogen absorb very efficiently, or to be more precise, scatter the light out of the line of sight of distant objects. So even if I have only a little bit of neutral hydrogen, it's a very efficient way of actually tracing that. What is the case is that the neutral hydrogen in the oval distribution in the intergalactic medium is photoionized. So you balance recombinations with photoionizations, and that plays a role in how exactly the neutral hydrogen is actually related to the dark matter distribution. So if you look a bit, little bit back, then you will find that there's a larger contrast in the density and the neutral hydrogen than there is in the dark matter. The reason for that is that that basically scales as a density squared, and that's the photoionization physics. So even so, that is a nice representation. It goes here with the density squared, so you get a higher contrast, but that's very well understood. And you can put that into a computer and do the hydrodynamical simulation, including with that. So that's not actually a problem. So when we're looking at the neutral hydrogen, what we are using is we're using absorption line spectra. So we're looking at a distant object, and we're looking at the material between us and the object. And that's a little animation that one of our grad students, Andrew Ponson, has done. And that's really for the benefit of the people who are a bit further away from the field. So what you do is, if you look at a quasar, and here you see the Lyme alpha emission of the quasar, and as the light passes from the quasar to us, it hits the neutral hydrogen on the way, and this imprints the absorptions here, and as you go on, this absorption line spectra just goes on, and it's basically just a Lyme alpha transition times one plus that, and you get a nice record along the line of sight of the neutral hydrogen along the line of sight. Occasionally, it hits a galaxy. When it hits a galaxy, you get a very strong absorption system, and you can use the same method to study galaxies in detail too, and that's what I do a lot too, but that will not be part of this talk, and I will not talk about this any further. So I will skip that, and what I will do is I will concentrate on using these kind of spectra to constrain the metapower spectrum on small scales. I will at the end talk a little bit about a new thing, what you might do with a large telescope, is called the redshift drift, and all the other stuff is things I generally work on, but will not be able to touch on here. The reason why you get nice constraints is because there are nice data sets around. And what you see here now is real data, and not this little cartoon that I've shown before from high resolution, high signal to noise spectra. So this is a QSO absorption spectrum. They have taken out the internal distribution of the emission of the quasar and have normalized it to one. And I see now just the absorption. So what I'm measuring here is the amount of neutral hydrogen along the line of sight. Here's a damped Lyme alpha system, as you had seen in this little animation. And to convince you of the quality of the data, I've blown up here the wavelength scale time two times by a factor of 10. And there you see that you get a very nice record of the neutral hydrogen along the line of sight, and there's virtually no noise in that. And if I take a high resolution spectrum, I actually get an exquisite record of the neutral hydrogen along the line of sight. Which scale? I think what you see here, this is about these smaller lines, it's about the gene slings. So these things are half thermally broadened, half Hubble flow broadened. So this is about the gene slings in velocity space. It's a few gene slings if you take a big line here. So these spectra are very expensive. So that's an eye of 10 meter telescope fine. So if you wanted to take these high resolution spectra, you can't take them in. What you can do is you can take lots of low resolution spectra like this, can do the same, but then you really see that these are pretty poor quality. But you can have lots of them. And that's something what Patrick McDonald, whom you might have heard talking about, that spent a lot of time making these spectra actually available and usable. And we're all very grateful that he put so much effort in to make these spectra that are not taken for this purpose, that he made these usable for this by really putting a lot of effort in sorting out the systematics that you have from this relatively poor quality spectra. And in the end, if you have the choice between the two, they're sort of complementary. With the high resolution spectra, you can study systematic uncertainties. With the low resolution spectra, you can get high statistical significance by taking many of these spectra. So there's a large sample. And what you basically do is you want to get the metapower spectrum, and you measure the equivalent fluctuation spectrum in the flux distribution, what's called the flux power spectrum. And the real nice thing is that you can do that nicely sliced in redshift. And that's the Sloan sample that Patrick has prepared. And what you see there is the fluctuations in the flux, the Fourier transform of the flux distribution, nicely binned in different redshifts. So the sets of pros are that you have many spectra, you get small statistical errors, you have a wide redshift range, but you have to make large corrections for the noise and resolution. So it's not an easy data set to deal with, but in the end, the effort pays off. So what you do then is you take the observed spectra, and as you see, the spectra are obviously not a linear probe of what you're looking at, so you really have to do some careful modeling, and you do hydro simulations, and then you get spectra that look in their statistical properties very similar, and you can then take the flux power spectrum just the same way and compare them one to one. So this is the results that you get for the cutoff, and what the spectra are really best of, and that's something what they can really do very well, is getting that cutoff, because they are getting to the range of that cutoff, and this cutoff is relatively easy to detect. So what you do here is you combine the high resolution and the low resolution data, and with the high resolution data you get into that cutoff, and as you go to the highest redshift you get most sensitive, and you use the lower resolution data to anchor your point and to fix some of the other parameters that you have into too. And at the rightmost upper end, you see how you sensitive to particles of something like 1.25 kV. And Seljak et al., of which Patrick is one of the adults, they got a constraint of a Wormdike metamass of 2.54 kV. So we have, on a very similar time scale, done a lot of similar work. And in this case, what we have done, we have pushed it even a bit further. And what we have done is we have taken a very nice sample of high-resolution spectra, 55 keck spectra, each one a night of 10 meter time. And this sample goes to even higher redshift. And it turns out that you're most sensitive at the highest redshift, the reason being that there's a scaling between velocity and the scale of the free steaming scale is most favorable at high redshift. And this way, you can push it even further and get a constraint on the warm dark metaparticle mass that if it's 2 sigma for a thermal relic, it's larger than 4 kV.
For high redshift, or is it smaller? I forget how it goes.
The gene scale in megaparsec gets. You look at that in redshift space, and in redshift space, basically gene links go to somewhat to the to larger scales, to smaller scales, larger k.
As time progresses,
right? Yeah. So you get the best constraints at the highest redshift.
Is the damping that we're seeing, you're saying, is coming just from the gene sampling?
There is a thermal cutoff too, and you have to be careful how you measure that too. But it's basically the genes thing goes to the right on this plot, so that you see the cutoff better. As you go to higher redshift, you're less non-linear too. So you're more in the linear regime, and that makes it easier to measure too. For those reasons, you get the best constraints at the smaller scale with higher redshift.
Sorry, it looks from that like you should be able to constrain to a higher amounts. Why is it only 4 kV?
Now you wanted at 2 sigma, the other parameters you marginalize over 2, and that is just for one particular model. So you have to marginalize over the thermal state of the gas, so that's just one particular model. So you can, for this, you obviously see it, if that would be all of it, but you marginalize over a lot of other parameters, and you use all of the points, and that's the reason you can't go even further. So what that means is that dark matter is for all purposes that people are interested in galaxy formation is actually cold.
So there is this issue with Pat McDonald's lambda alpha fire state, which you get larger sigma 8. Do you get the same thing? Or?
We agree in our analysis in almost all points. So we get a pretty large sigma 8 too. But as you have seen, the sigma 8 has come up So I think if sigma 8 from the CMB is 0.2, then there's no statistically significant discrepancy. So you had seen the in the talk this morning, you saw that A is the constraint from the Lyme alpha force is pretty broad, and it has a broad banana,
yeah,
and depends on omega m where you actually are. And the reason for that is that the scaling from redshift space to real space depends on omega. And we get the same high values, and they used to be 2.5 sigma discrepant with the CMB. If the CMB is actually moving up by half a sigma or one sigma, then actually the discrepancy is more or less gone. So we're very happy to live with the sigma 0.85. I think everything below 0.8 with the Lyme alpha force starts to become a problem. 0.85 is no problem whatsoever.
So, can we go back to the previous slide? So, I think you answered this question, but I really didn't understand the answer. The solid lines are simulation. What causes the maximum? What causes the turnover at large K in the simulation?
There's a thermal cutoff. So there's a gene length in the gas. So there are no fluctuations beyond a certain scale in K, because the pressure takes out the fluctuations. And what we're doing with that method is that we're pushing the constraints from the cutoff from warm dark matter, who looks very similar, up to the gene scale. And that's the smaller scales that you can go.
But the top curve, which would be no warm dark matter, that entirely depends on the temperature of the scales.
We have taken simulations with temperature of the gas up to the maximum we think is reasonable. So the gas is photoheated, so we think we understand the thermal state of the gas sufficiently well that we can put a lower limit on how to low K the thermal cutoff could come.
And the top curve is for the central value of that temperature, or it's an extreme?
That's just for one model, and I showed just one model, and we didn't take the constraints from that plot, but we ran lots of models, did a full proper statistical analysis and marginalized the whole parameters.
I understand. But for my low-level explanation, this is a typical model rather than...
That's probably a relatively cold model. Yeah, would be my guess. I don't remember which one we put on the plot, but it's one on the cold side.
So for colder gas even, the damping would be even less, right?
If it's one on the cold side, that's probably the iron. The hotter ones would basically make it harder to detect.
So why can't it be more cold than this?
Yeah, we can measure the temperature independently, and we know the physics.
At this redshift, you can measure the temperature independently?
That would be a different talk. I think we even believe that we can do it now at this redshift. And what we do is, if you look into the proximity zone of high redshift quasars, you have a little bit of flux left in the proximity of the quasars. It goes out to pretty large distances because these are so bright. And we looked into the thermal broadening of the lines in the proximity zone. And we're just finishing a paper where we think we can measure that there too. But I agree that there's nothing published yet at redshift, at high redshift, at redshift 5 or so. Yeah? And I think you can do that too. And at redshift 4, 3, and 2, it's not so difficult. And we marginalize over a wider range of temperatures anyway. So we go pretty high in what we do. So what does it mean for galaxy formation? So if I now put onto the plot what kind of halos that corresponds to this 4 keV, then out down to halos of 10 to the 8 solar masses, the warm dark matter model that's still viable and consistent with the data is identical to lambda CDM. So you have to go to halos below 10 to the 8.5 in dark matter mass to get into the loud range where there's still an effect at that cutoff. So up to here, I think we're quite confident that everything just looks like lambda CDM. For halos that small, the gas physics or the galaxy formation physics clears out the halos anyway. If I form a few stars in these halos, they normally expel all the gas. So I think from an astrophysical point of view, the dark matter is actually cold. with that, the definition that I have given. If we want to go to even smaller scale, I think we will not be able to do that with galaxies or with the Lyman Alpha Forest. We have to basically go beyond drainization so that the gas has a temperature that's below 10 to the 4 Kelvin, the typical photoionization temperature. And the only way to do that is to do that with 21 centimeter vision emission before ionization. So if we want to push that further, we have to really go to something else, and that's a bit in the future. So I had talked a bit about the small scale crisis of CDM. And this is one of these nice pictures from Volker Springer, where he actually shows quite convincingly how many blobs there actually are in a big halo. And there are obviously not that many galaxies typically around if I go into a group environment. This was a picture I'd shown before, that's a bit lower resolution, and that's a smaller halo, but there's a difference here too. But I think that has been more or less resolved, so that's the difference you would expect for different particle masses. And the reason that has been resolved is that there have been found now many more satellite galaxies than there used to be. So the same Sloan survey that actually produced these nice flux power spectra had a part where that was used to look for satellite galaxies in our local group. And what the Sloan has done is that it has basically more than doubled the number of known small galaxies in the local group. And more importantly, it has done so with defining very carefully a detection threshold for these and making a selection function as a function of radius for these halos. They have all been found very deep in the Milky Way halo, or where the local groups are sitting in. And we can now use the selection function to extrapolate how many small galaxies we would expect in the total local group. So if you go to 4 kV, 5 kV, you're getting pretty much to lambda CDM.
How are these halos defined? I mean, these are friends of friends halos or whatever?
They are normally friends of friends halos, yeah. I think that, I don't know what these have done. I haven't checked that. There was a paper that came out last week. So Volker always uses friends of friends halos. I think I haven't checked what they have done.
You can't really believe like the masses then. I mean,
well, it's.
I wouldn't use that as a quantitative thing, but yeah. Just to basically show how different it gets. But what these people have done is they have now tried to model the number of satellites in the local group. And several people have done that now. There was the Fourier simulations, there was the Via Lacta simulations. And I think the general agreement is that you can now get the right number of satellites if you put enough feedback into the small mass halos. And there's now a whole range of groups that have produced the results, and there is no discrepancy anymore between the number of satellites. They're very credible models that actually get the number of satellites exactly right. And what these guys have done last week is they actually have done that for warm dark matter, and they go the other way. They show that there would be warm dark matter of a certain mass, and you actually wouldn't get enough satellites.
Using their prescription for feedback.
I wouldn't use that to constrain warm dark matter. I would use what we do. I just say that you get a consistent picture.
So,
I think this solution is complicated because the feedback, there's so many feedback models, and you can basically do what you want, but I think they're not different groups with different feedbacks who will get it. And probably all the feedback is wrong, but I think there's enough range, I think, to do that astrophysically. You don't have to appeal to the dark matter to do the problem for you.
One other thing is that the ultra faints are close to the Milky Way, and if you just match up the numbers, probably in warm dark matter, you'll be left with the biggest things, which will be further away. So I would believe this, basically. I believe there's a stronger constraint than you get just from matching numbers with the imperial rings.
They use now the selection function, so they now model for the whole halo. And I think the main advance from the Sloan was not finding these extra 10 satellites. Okay, what's the difference? You have two more, there was a big discrepancy before. I think the main difference is they have a well-defined selection function.
Yeah, but it's
and they could, and so the most of the satellites are much larger radii, and they could they have established that most of the satellites in the local group you couldn't see because they're too far away.
Exactly. So the ones they found, they've doubled the number within the central third of the halo in radius.
But there's another there's another factor, 10 to 30 larger radii, that we know now should be there.
Yeah.
And that we are absolutely sure that we couldn't have seen them because they have the selection function. And I think that's the main advantage from the Sloan data, that they basically could establish what couldn't have been seen before. And that there must be many more of the same size and larger than here. So I don't want to talk about this, and I don't want to talk about this. I just want to repeat that I think we have established this Lyme alpha forest. It's really the best data for that. So down to the galaxy scale, the dark matter is actually cold. I think you can play other games with that and try to constrain sterile neutrinos with that. And there the things become much more model dependent. So if you assume a sterile neutrino that's produced what's called by the Donaldson-Widrow mechanism, then you get the sterile neutrinos in a plot where you plot the sine squared theta against the mass of the sterile neutrino that lies on this line if it makes up all the dark matter. And then our constraint in terms of the sterile neutrinos would not be 4 keV, but they have a different streaming length, and that would go to close to 30 keV, so that would push us over here. Then there are other constraints here that come from the looking at the X-ray emission from different astrophysical probes, and the sterile neutrinos would be expected to decay. And what they have looked for is a decay for the decay lines that corresponds to different masses. And together with the mixing angle, you can constrain the flux so that it gives you the constraint that comes from this way. So this mechanism would be completely ruled out. But as I understand, none of the particle physicists would believe that that's a credible model anyway. I think if you go to something, what they call the minimal extended standard model for neutrinos, where you have 3 sterile neutrinos, the things get more complicated. The free streaming length depends on the uncertain production mechanism. And then these constraints are still interesting, but not as clear cut. But I think what I understood is what you then get a result too, is that the warm dark matter that you get, that the dark matter that you could get from sterile neutrinos would be mostly cold too, so it wouldn't be warm anymore. So for our argument, it wouldn't make any difference. So you can't rule out the sterile neutrinos that way, not even that they make the dark matter, but what you can rule out is that most of the dark matter that you get from sterile neutrinos would be warm. I think that I'll probably skip too, unless someone in the audience is really keen on discussing that. There was a paper last Friday where Kuzenko claimed that he has found a 2.5 keV line from the decay of sterile neutrinos, and it's not that whopping line here, that's actually foreground line. It's this little residual here. But I think if you don't insist, I would just say you shouldn't believe that. I think it contradicts a lot of other things, and I think masses of active neutrinos I probably better skip too. Because I wanted to talk a little bit about the cosmological redshift drift. So that's something else I got interested in, and I have agreed to act as a project scientist for an instrument for an ELT, and that's something what you may want to do with that. And what is a redshift drift? I think if we think about how actually redshifts come about in a cosmological context, then we generally assume that we have a Robertson-Walker metric, and the redshift is just ratio of the scale factors at emission and observation. And there's nothing going in of your theory of gravity yet. You basically just have the metric, and the redshift is completely independent of that. So what you could try to do is you could try to measure how this redshift actually changes in real time. So obviously, if I wait for a while, the redshift to change. It's very easy to work out that that's a very tiny effect, but I think it comes into range of actually doing that, and I will try to convince you a little bit that that's the case. So if I work out what this redshift change would be, then I get that the change of the redshift with time depends on the Hubble constant at the present time times 1 plus that minus the Hubble constant at when the photon was emitted. So if I could measure that in real time, I would measure this combination of the Hubble constant at the present time and at early times. I think that would be a very interesting thing to do. That idea is not new. I think Alan Sandage came up with that more than 40 years ago. But as he says, for reasonable observing times, say 100 years, it is exceedingly small. That was a statement done in the time when the telescopes were quite a bit smaller. And I think you can bring that down from 100 years to 10 years now. And it's so small that you can actually measure it. And there are a lot of practical problems with that too. But I think that can be solved. And I think it's sufficiently interesting that we should actually push for that. So what comes to the help for doing that in the end will be a large telescope. So I said the signal is very small. So how small is the signal? So what's shown here is that redshift drift in centimeters per second per year as a function of redshift of the object that I look at. And you see it's really centimeters per second per year. And I think most of you will not be spectroscopists, but that's a frightening small number. I think it gets even worse if it would still live in a standard CDM model. The factor would actually be substantially larger. It turns out that our preferred cosmology actually minimizes the signal. That's Murphy's law, but that's the way it is. There's no particular reason for that. That's just a coincidence. So that, I think we're confident we would be able to measure very easily and get very, very strong constraints on this relatively little effort. But just that just doesn't, it's quite a bit harder. So what would you like to use to do that? So what you in principle would like to have is a very sharp line, then you can measure the center of the line better. So the narrower the line, the sharper, the better. So in principle, you would like maybe to go for molecular lines. In the end, if you think about it, it turns out that the Lyman alpha force is actually the tool of choice. And the reason being that you don't have enough suitable lines that are sharp, and they're normally deep in potential wells. They have a lot of peculiar velocities, and you have a lot of systematic effects that you don't have under control. The Lyman alpha force, on the other side, is very stable. The peculiar velocities are small, and the main thing what gives you an advantage here is that you have so many lines. So you can predict the signal at every point in redshift, and therefore in wavelengths. So you can use all the lines and add them up. And in the end, what you need is photons to make that accurate. And so you want to use all the photons, and here you can use, have lots of features, and that beats that they're not that sharp.
The slope of the continuum changing, because that seems as very similar.
The slope of the continuum changing will not be systematic.
It will not be systematic?
And you don't only do that for one quasar, you will do that for many quasars, and it has a very distinctive redshift signal. So you saw there was a zero crossing, and then it goes from positive to negative, and that would be very hard to mimic. But that's something you have to worry about, and that's one of the systematics you have to do very well, I completely agree. But as I said, that would, here on this plot, it seems easy, but that's for 10 to 7 years, and we are not willing to wait for 10 to 7 years. So the signal is very, very small. So what might help you to do it is a large telescope. And you might be a bit frightened about these centimeters a second accuracy too. But as I here remind you that when people look for planets, what they look actually is for radio velocity wobble. And the Geneva group has developed a very nice spectrograph that has found many, many planets and the planets that have the smallest radial velocity changes, they come now down even a bit lower than that, so they get to the regime that approaches 10 centimeters per second. So that's a spectrograph that's already existing with spectrograph technology that's already 30 years old. It's box standard spectrographs with calibration lamps, so there's no new technology in whatsoever. They have the advantage that they can look at bright stars and don't have to look at faint quasars. So they have an easier time to get lots of photons to get the center of lines very much, much more accurate than actually the width of the line. That's what you're actually trying to do, is you're trying to get the center of lines much more accurately than actually the width of the line is. And for that, you need just many, many photons to do, and a very accurate spectrograph. What?
Yeah. You're not going
to be able to do that. Now, we have a very complicated template, too. So we have a template at epoch 1, at epoch 2, so we have even more lines. That's the reason why we pick some line out to focus to that. So there's, I think on that front, I think we're even better off, because they actually line everywhere. So that's what, I wouldn't advocate building a spectrograph like that for an ELT just for the redshift instrument. So there's a wide-ranging science case for that, and I think there's a good science case for building an ultra-stable, high-resolution spectrograph that's called CODEX. And one of them is that redshift experiment, but there's quite a bit more too.
I'm also wondering, I mean, I guess you can take this out, but how big is the, there must be a drift in gravitational redshift of the Earth with time.
From, yeah.
Say, the moon changing its orbit and stuff like that. I wonder what amplitude that is.
You have to worry about all these effects, but the people who actually do that for a living have convinced me that they basically are able to deal with that. And they already got to 10 centimeters a second, so it's not a
second. But for instance, for the planets, you're looking for a very, you know, a variation. Presumably, you take out drifts on a 100-year or 10-year time scale.
You will take drifts out too. I think the key to that will be the key for that will be basically very accurate calibration. I will show you a bit on that too. So that's something that's actually under phase A study for the ELT. So there are actually people spending money to design it in detail. So that's a preliminary design for that spectrograph. And I think the exciting bit is that there has been a new calibration tool that has become available. And I think the people in quantum physics have developed something what's called a frequency comp. So that's something what produces lines that are evenly spaced of the same intensity in a reproducible fashion by actually taking radio frequencies and mixing them and getting them in. So you get an almost perfect calibration source. And initially they were only able to get the lasers and the infrared to do that. But I think the nice thing is that the MPQ is actually just next door to ESO, so these people talk to each other. And they actually have already built the prototype for this spectrograph parts, where they took this new kind of calibration. And what you see here is these equally spaced lines. And on top of it, there are spectra. And here you see these nice lines in one order. We have actually perfectly wavelength calibrated calibration source. And this is what people used to use. So that is a calibration lab. So there you see unevenly spaced or unequal intensity lines. And with that, they got to 10 centimeters a second. So with this calibration source, to get to higher accuracy and taking out a lot of systematic effects, I think I'm not worried about that the people will be able to do that. I think the main problem is to get the photons. Phases are not that bright, so what you need to do is you have to go for the brightest phases that you find so that you get enough photons. And what we have done here is we have taken a realistic sample of quasars and tried to figure out what accuracy you can get if you put all your observing time into one quasar. What you will do in the end is you will take a range of quasars or a range of redshift to do that. And easily they actually make you write something like what's called a design reference mission. So that you went to the exercise of writing a real proposal and think about how we would do the details, which quasars. And that's kind of what you would get. for a realistic proposal, what you might ask for time if you're ambitious, measuring the redshift drift as a function of redshift. And I think it's worth trying. I think what's the nice thing about that method is that time plays on your side. So if you wait, the signal will obviously just get linearly larger. And I think now is the time to build spectrographs that you can start measuring that. And then you can just can keep going. You can leave it to your children and your grandchildren. And at some stage, you'll measure it extremely well. And you don't have to put large amounts of observation time in. You just have to keep going. And that's a little bit of how astronomy operates. I think we're still benefiting from observations that have been taken 100 years ago and several hundred years ago. And once you can measure something well, you should do measure it well. And maybe by the time you start doing that, you know it all anyway. Then we don't do it, then we use a spectrograph to find all the nice planets. But I think if in 10, 15 years' time we're still arguing, then I think it's worth doing and starting these measurements and keep going. You can do other nice things to that, and I think one other thing what is done with absorption spectra is that people have claimed that fundamental constants are varying. So you might have seen that result from Murphy et al. That they claimed that delta alpha over alpha is not constant. That alpha is not constant, so there's a delta alpha over alpha of the order of one part in 100,000. This is a very controversial result, and I must admit that I don't believe it. And it's probably due to the wavelength calibration. And it's just, they're just basically at the limit of what you can do in terms of wavelength calibration. And they haven't found yet what is wrong. But in the end, I think they will find what is wrong with the wavelength calibration. And my guess is the result is coming away. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe not. But that seems more likely. What's a nice thing would be with a spectrograph like Kodak's is that you can go two orders of magnitude below that. And more importantly, you will bring the stuff into the photon noise limit. So I think with these nice new calibration sources, I don't think wavelength calibration will be the thing to argue about anymore. And once you're in the photon noise limited, you will understand the statistics of the noise, and you will just look at your error bars and see if they correspond to what you would expect or not. So you can go to much lower levels, and you can will have a much better wavelength accuracy. And finally, what I always say when I try to find a spectrograph, I think if you measure spectra well, I think history has told us that quite often things just pop up. So if you measure things with a lot of photons and measure the spectra very well, who knows what happens. And one thing that could happen, what I don't want to advocate as being right either, so people have come up with models where the varying of fundamental constants is actually related to the dark energy in a systematic fashion. And if that would be the case, and I can measure it, and I can measure W well, then I would get really nice constraints on my theory. That I just mentioned it as an example. I don't think this particular theory that's proposed here has any credibility, but I think there's enough out there that you should be flexible in terms of opening up just a parameter space. So I'm coming to an end. And so what I've tried to convince you is that for astrophysical purposes, dark matter is really cold, where at the moment we take this 10 to the 9 solar mass as a scale where we think astrophysically it's interested because at smaller scales, the genes mass of 10 to the 4 K is just about that size. And B, in the smaller galaxies, the feedback processes dominate anyway, and you will not see these because they don't form efficiently stars. I think if you want to constrain stereo neutrinos, then you have to look a bit closer, and I just brushed over that. And at the end, I tried to convince you that centimeter spectroscopic accuracy should be in reach with ELTs, and there's a wide range of things that you will learn from that.
I'd like to ask a question about something that you skipped.
Yeah, sure.
So Another claim that you need warm dark matter is based on the statement that cold dark matter predicts cusping halos, and the experimental observations contradict that. And you skipped a slide where you dismissed this statement. And I'd just like to know what you think.
I think there's the observational situation is pretty murky, because you don't quite know what mass the halo of a galaxy has. So you have actually a wide range of halos that you can fit to these profiles. And so there's an endless debate on how well the dark matter halos in CDM actually fit. I think having said that, in the end, I think there is some argument that that small galaxies have cores that you don't produce in the same way in CDM. I think the idea there is that the bionic physics can produce these cores. And the old idea was to remove some baryons by adiabatic expansion to do something. What has happened over the last 2 or 3 years is that people found a different mechanism to do that. And that is, if you make gas moving in these halos at velocities that's similar to the characteristic velocity of the halo, you can resonantly heat the dark matter. So there are people made simple models by taking a halo and having just the gas swashing around along the three principal axis, and they showed that that efficiently heats the dark matter. Everybody thought that's nice, not surprising, but a silly model. The same people a year later came back with actual numerical simulations where they had outflowing gas, where they obviously had hit the right velocities, and where they showed that works too. And there was last week a paper that has a simulation with feedback too, where they exactly claim the same. So they are after making realistic dwarf galaxies. And so they have here a set of simulations with different resolutions, different star formation recipes, and different feedback recipes. And so they have halos that are more cuspy and ones that have a nice halo that you just get out of the cosmological simulation with a mechanism that is just described. And in the one case, the dark matter dominated. So in the one case, you get very cuspy rotation curves. In the other case, you get slowly rising rotation curves. That makes them, so that's Governato et al., that makes them bulge-less dwarf galaxies that get rotation curves that fit something like one of these dwarf galaxies that has a linearly rising rotation curve and a core. I think other people would say you could also put that into a very massive halo veil in the very inner part, and they have a relatively shallow shelf anyway, so there's some room of maneuver to fit that even with a cuspy halo by going into the turnover where even the cuspy halo turns over. So they go to -1 and then they go to even shallower. And that's the reason why there was never a conclusion, because the people who are advocates of CDM always said you're taking the wrong halos to fit. If I take the right halos, they fit anyway. But I think those together and what I've shown you before, that warm dark matter doesn't have enough structure to actually let the Lyman alpha force go to the smallest scale. I am now convinced that that has an astrophysical solution.
The way you look for the line shift and line up, you know, that's the H dot, by actually fitting to many lines and looking for fitting to them and fitting to them again in the subsequent data set and looking for an overall specific,
you,
or do you just morph?
Now you use the epoch 1 spectrum as a template, and then you look for the differences in the other spectrum. You take a derivative of that and see what you have, and then you will basically have changes all the way, but you look at their systematic. And you have a model for how they should change. So you can make basically a model for how your spectrum should look like at the second epoch for certain parameters, and then you see which model actually fits best. So theoretically, that works all fine. So we have done that with Mach spectra, and if you have enough photons, and if you have the systematic wavelength calibration and control, it gets a signal out. It's just.
Aren't you basically stretching, sort of shifting and stretching one spectra, and hoping that it'll match the other ones? You can't just shift and stretch and see for one shift and stretch, you have maximum correlation.
Yeah. In practice, I can take the epoch one spectrums, take the noise out of it, take for certain parameters the stretch that I have, take that as a model for the epoch two spectra, see if it fits, and do that for a variety of stretches for different parameters, and then I get the velocity shaped out.
Plot that you showed for what kind of time interval did you sort of your 10 years?
The one I'm going to show is 10 to 7 years.
No. I mean, you showed basically this morning constraints on the.
That was for 10 years. 10 years plus the time observation at both ends. So it was 10 years between the last observation of the epoch 1 and the first observation of epoch 2. So in practice, it would be something like 15 years from start to end. So it's not something for the impatient.
Yeah, so how sensitive are you to just the linear evolution of the Lyapunov forest? Because you've got blobs on small scales that are moving around.
The peculiar velocities are completely random on much smaller scales. So the one thing has this redshift signal that goes from redshift 2 to redshift 4. But the random motion of the Lyapunov forest basically goes positive and negative on scales of 10 megaparsec or so. So that just acts as a random noise. And if you go through the numbers.
If you got the amplitude of that noise, that's telling you something about.
This noise is much smaller than the photon noise by orders of magnitude. And you can go through the numbers and convince you very quickly it's 2 to 3 orders of magnitude smaller than the photon noise. It's just 10 years is not a long time. So the stuff doesn't move far over 10 years.
That's the next thing. That's the next thing to do once you measure this.
As I said, it's 3 orders of magnitude smaller than the signal. As we are struggling to see that, we will not go for the other one.
All right.
I think that's just impossible. I think, yeah.
I think we should probably move on. The next speaker is Mayu Lan.